Okay, so I have written here some bibliography of some stuff that you can read. Especially the lecture today is based on a couple of chapters of the book by Subir Sachdev. And I'm giving lecture notes, and I really advise you to read this old paper. It's a long paper, very long, actually covers the material for the whole course by Kogut. It's a review of modern physics, and it is an introduction to spin systems and lattice gauge theory. So as we will see in the second week, lattice gauge theory is very interesting because it allows us to understand a new kind of order in matter that is not based on symmetry breaking. So symmetry breaking is what we are looking at now, but then we have something that goes beyond that paradigm. And one example of this is materials that in the ground state are, or at low energies are like gauge theory, lattice gauge theory. Well, we will see that later. So so as we saw yesterday, all that is interesting in so far we saw that so let me spend a couple more words about what we saw yesterday. So yesterday we saw that in the Ising model, in the quantum Ising model, so we have one parameter only, that is this G, okay? And for a critical value of GC that is equal 1, this separates two phases, one that we call paramagnet, that is, that preserves the symmetry. And the other one that is an ordered ferromagnet that is a symmetry breaking. Right? What it means is that there are the two ground states that do not preserve the Z2 symmetry, whereas the Hamiltonian has this symmetry always for every G. But at small g, we have a favorite basis such that T on the first state in this basis goes to the other one. So this is a favorite symmetry breaking basis. So the whole phenomenon of symmetry breaking happens because there is this favorite basis. And the reason why there is a favorite basis is because in this basis, the operator that connects these two states is global. Whereas all the noise, so the interaction with the environment or imperfections in the Hamiltonian, is local. Other bases that are not symmetry breaking are connected by local operators. Local in the same sense of the locality of the other interactions that are in play. So you see that the very phenomenon of symmetry breaking requires that we understand what is local and what is not. Okay? So what is local means that we have chosen a tensor product structure, what are the physical degrees of freedom, and that we know which degrees of freedom are near which. And then we need to know how the support of these operators relates to these notions. So that's why I introduced some graph theoretic notions yesterday, because they are necessary. So they are the right language to express these things. For instance, when I say, when yesterday I explained what is a local Hamiltonian, it has to be phrased in that language. And in the next days, we will see some more sophisticated theorems that are very important. And they actually require that we really, that, you know, I cannot just wave my hands and say, oh yeah, you know, the Ising Hamiltonian is local in some sense. We really need to be precise about what is locality in a, for instance, in a quantum spin system. So we do need those graph theoretic notions. So the other comment I want to make is that, so you see, if I move, so I have my Hamiltonian, HG, that is the Hamiltonian of the Ising mode. So let me write it here again. So where do I put the G usually? Here. So I've written it in 1D for a chain. So as I change G, I have a ground state of this Hamiltonian associated to G, right? So I am moving, let's say, continuously in this manifold. Then at some point, this continuous deformation of this wave function fails because there is a quantum phase transition. Then here I can move continuously again. And we see that these are two distinct phases that are distinguished by the fact that they break at Z2 symmetry. But I have to impose that as I move, the way I move, in some sense, preserves the Z2 symmetry. What do I mean by that? So imagine that I because so. That's, first of all, what does it mean that I preserve the Z2 symmetry? You see, this move is obtained by changing the Hamiltonian a little bit and then diagonalizing again and going again to the ground state. Then I change it again a little bit and I diagonalize again. As you know, if I do it slowly enough, it is like starting from psi 0 at G equals 0, then changing the Hamiltonian very slowly and looking at the time evolution. So if this change is slow enough, then we will later we will explain exactly how slow it has to be. But right now, let's say infinitely slow, then I am always in this instantaneous eigenstate, instantaneous ground state of my Hamiltonian. Okay? So this is called adiabatic continuation. So this operator, this unitary operator that is the time evolution, is the exponentiation of the Hamiltonian. So it is also Z2 symmetry. Okay? So I am evolving my state by preserving the symmetry. So if I impose this symmetry constraint, so I move by conserving the symmetry, then I find this obstruction, and it makes sense to say, oh, we have two different phases, in which one in which the symmetry is broken, one in which the symmetry is preserved in the state. But imagine that I evolve in a way that breaks explicitly the symmetry. So even the way I move is breaking the symmetry. So I add a field like this. So now my phase diagram is two-dimensional. I have G and I have H. So we know that this is GC equal 1 is a critical point. But actually, this is the only point where the gap closes. Because for every H greater than 0, let me put a minus here, just for the sake of simplicity, I open a gap between my, for instance, when G is equal to 0, and initially I did my two ground states that were all spins up and all spins down. Now you see that this opens a gap between these two states, a gap that is 2H, and the ground state is all spins up, unique ground state. So this means that if I now change continuously these two parameters, so I have a path in this phase diagram, I can go from here to here without encountering a phase transition. So the phase diagram, when you talk about symmetry breaking, makes sense if you impose some restrictions in the way you can move. So if you say, oh, I can, when I move, I need to, so my unitary evolution must be Z2 symmetric. Then my phase diagram splits in two parts, one that is symmetry preserving and one that is symmetry breaking. Otherwise, I can connect these two phases. So if here I had the space of all my possible quantum ground states, and I impose that I move according some different symmetries, then I could have a picture like this, where this thing splits in different symmetry broken sectors, depending on what symmetry I'm using to move. And then we have a question, is this picture exhaustive? So can we label all the possible ground states of, say, local Hamiltonians just to in this way? So in other words, imagine that we do not put any restriction in how we move in the parameter space. So this means that our Hamiltonian can be anything. Can I connect any two states? So imagine that I have the ground state psi 0, 1 of some local Hamiltonian H1. And then I have this order that is the ground state of some other completely different Hamiltonian H2. And then I have some family of Hamiltonians, H lambda, such that at lambda equals 0, H of 0 is H1, and at lambda equals 1, so this is some curve in the multidimensional parameter space, H of 1 is H2. Okay? Is it always possible that the time order product of this thing, so this is the unitary operator that adiabatically deforms the states, applied to psi 0, 1 is psi 0, 2. Can I always adiabatically connect any two states? in that are ground states of local Hamiltonians. So we have just seen that if this family H lambda is restricted to obey some symmetry, we have just seen, so this is the meaning of quantum phase transitions, that it's not always possible. If this H lambda must be Z to symmetric, then I cannot connect a state in here and a state in here. But we just see that if I break this symmetry, then I can connect them. So in general, if I can break any symmetry, or if I have no whatsoever restriction on this family, but the boundary conditions, can I always connect two states? So let's first phrase the question really generally. If H lambda can be any Hermitian operator in the Hilbert space, can I do that? So this question, you already know the answer, so you must think. And why yes? No, you have to speak louder because I'm deaf.
I'm not sure, sorry.
So the reason is that for any two states in the Hilbert space, there is always a unitary operator that connects them. So if I and any unitary operator is the exponentiation of some Hermitian operator. So if I have no restriction on the Hermitian operators, I can realize any unitary operators. In particular, I can connect any two states. So the first answer is trivial. But I really said no restriction whatsoever. So now let's put the first restriction that is not symmetry. We have already understood that if we put symmetry, then this manifold of possible ground states splits. But let's put a weaker restriction. Let's say that my Hamiltonian can be any Hamiltonian as long as it's a local Hamiltonian, which means, I remind you, the sum of local operators in the sense that we defined yesterday. Now, is it still true? Okay, so this is the question. So this is not a trivial question. If I can, so in this example, we saw that at least these two faces can be connected just by breaking the symmetry, but I still have a local Hamiltonian. So this restriction of locality is not forbidding us to go, say, to this, from this face to this face without encountering a phase transition. But how do we know that there are no disconnected sectors that are also can split in other ways by symmetry, but such that if I can break any symmetry, yes, I can move in this sector, or I can move in this sector, but then I cannot go from here to here. How do we know that? So we don't know, I mean, now we know, but at this moment, we don't know yet. So part of this course is to understand that symmetry breaking classifies the faces up to a certain point. But there are disconnected sectors that cannot be connected by just changing the symmetry. So these other sectors are those that are called topologically ordered, and we will try to understand what they mean. Okay. So the topic of today is a very beautiful topic that is very useful in condensed matter theory and is the mapping between classical and quantum models. So classical quantum mapping. This mapping also allows us to illustrate, it's a way to illustrate what is the universality of a face. So today I give two examples. So one is a mapping between a classical model and a quantum model, and then another example of a mapping between a quantum model and a classical model. Okay, so let's start for the first one. So let's start with a classical model. And this classical model is the one-dimensional Ising model. So it's almost the same, but it's classical. So let's see if we can write it. So maybe you want to try to tell me what is the Hamiltonian for the classical model. It resembles that one, but it's a bit different. So we will call our variables Ising spins. So instead of writing sigma or something like that, I will write at every site a variable s that can have two values, plus one and minus one. Prima facie, this is not very different from writing sigma z, because even if this is a matrix, also this has two eigenvalues that are plus one and minus one. So it doesn't, at this level, it's not much difference. Anyway, the model is this one. So, can you tell me in what is different from the quantum
Really a sigma x term. It's like the first term is a sigma z.
So, one obvious difference is that it's true that I can assimilate this to this, but then there I have sigma x and sigma z. So there's some non-trivial algebra, right, going on. Whereas here, whatever algebra is trivial. Okay, so this is mathematics. And in practice, what does it entail?
It's like having a bunch of spins that are under the influence of some magnetic field, which is played on it in the same direction, in one direction.
Yeah, but
So you're only allowing spin up or spin down, you're not allowing
yeah,
any
exactly.
particles in position.
So you see that every spin configuration is a state of definite energy of this Hamiltonian. You give a spin configuration, and it's a state that it has that energy. However, a given spin configuration is not a state of definite energy of that Hamiltonian, because these operators do not commute. So if I give you some spin configurations, all spins, even all spins up, for some intermediate value of g, this is not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Surely enough, it has some expectation value of the energy, but it is not a state of definite energy of the Hamiltonian. In other words, the states of definite energy are a superposition. So we have interference. Or, which is the same, the states that are just a spin configuration, they do not have a definite energy. So there are fluctuations. So that's why this is quantum mechanical and this is not. And this is obtained because sigma x does not commute with sigma z. If I write that Hamiltonian with, so if I consider g equals 0 and I switch on h, even if I've written it with matrices, this is actually still this model. Yes, I have defined quantum states that only describes spin configurations. And in that basis, they are all eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So that becomes a classical model. So it's not enough to write it with matrices. They must realize a non-trivial algebra, Otherwise, the diagonalization is trivial. And you have just a classical. You don't have superpositions of the original degrees of freedom. Okay. So this is a classical model in this sense. There is, in any spin configuration, there is no uncertainty in the energy. And we want, so you know, in statistical mechanics, all the thermodynamics is obtained by the free energy or the knowledge of the partition function. So we want to compute the partition function, and which is the sum over all the it's the trace of e to the minus beta h. So trace usually means, we know what it means when this is a matrix. Now this is some function. By trace here, I mean the sum over all the possible spin configurations. So I choose a spin configuration. I compute the Boltzmann factor associated to the spin configuration. And then I sum over all of them, and this is the partition function. Okay? Now let me define, because it's convenient for me, these two parameters that are just my couplings multiplied by the inverse temperature. So lambda is beta H, and K is beta J. OK. So let's compute this partition function. So as I said, I have the sum over all the spin configurations. And now I have to exponentiate this sum. Okay. Now the nice things of numbers is that they always commute. So the exponentiation of the sum is the product of exponents. So I can write it in this way. If I have a periodic boundary conditions, the last term is sigma n sigma 1, sorry, Sn S1. Okay? So this allows me, so it's important that I have periodic boundary conditions. But you can guess that the difference between open boundary conditions and closed boundary conditions in the thermodynamic limit is not very important. Because every time we compute the, you know, expectation value of local things. OK, so this will be equal to, let me write it this way, e to the lambda over 2, s1 plus s2, plus k s1 s2, times e lambda over 2. Then I can do this, s2 plus s3, plus k s2 s3, and so on and so forth until the last term. That because I have a boundary condition, it's this one. So do you agree that the sum of all these possible products is our partition function? OK. So now you see that all these terms have the same form, that is sum operator T that has two indices that are I and I plus 1. Okay, so let me call this operator that has these two indices TSI, TSI plus 1. Actually, it's just a number, right? So it is, just let me call it in this way.
Factor of 1/2 coming from?
Because look, we in this sum, for instance, look at this term. S2 appears like e to the minus h s2, right? H is what becomes lambda.
Yeah.
Okay? And here The way I'm writing this thing, I have S2 once here and once here, so I need one. Okay? So that in the sum I have the same thing. Yep.
did you forget the minus sign?
I think I have. Yeah.
It's e to the minus beta h.
No, because there is a minus here.
Okay.
I did. Okay. All right. So I can say that these are the matrix elements of some matrix. Right? So let's understand what matrix these are, the matrix elements. So these variables may have two possible values, right? So Si can be 0 or 1, sorry, plus 1 or minus 1. And this one can be plus 1 or minus 1. So in the basis Si plus 1, so what we can have is that they are both plus 1, right? So in this case, we would have e to the lambda plus k. Or one is plus 1 and the second one is minus 1, right? So this one would go to 0, and this one would become e to the minus k. And the same here. Or they're both minus 1, and in this case, I would have e to the minus lambda plus k. This matrix is called the transfer matrix. Later, we will understand why transfer. And this just means that now I can write this object in this way. You see, this is always the same matrix that is multiplied n times. And I am summing over all the possible realizations of this matrix. So this can be written this way. Very good. So now this is very nice because whereas this object is 2 to the n times 2 to the n dimensional, now, to find the eigenvalues of this object, I just need to find the eigenvalues of a 2x2 matrix. So that's pretty cool. And these eigenvalues are this thing. OK, it is what it is. And notice that epsilon 1 is greater than epsilon 2. These two eigenvalues are not degenerate. So this partition, it just becomes this, right? Because this matrix is diagonal. In the basis that diagonalizes it, of course, and the eigenvalues are this. So the sum of their eigenvalues to the n is the trace of t to the n. So let me go here now. Of course, we can write this as epsilon 1 to the n that multiplies 1 plus epsilon 2 over epsilon 1 to the n. It's trivial. But what happens in the thermodynamic limit? Well, since this is bigger than this, this vanishes. And all I get is epsilon 1 to the n. So for large n, I can approximate my partition function just with this guy. If you remember that k and lambda contain beta, you will see that this object is always analytic unless beta goes to infinity. So only for beta infinity, this expression becomes non-analytic. And this means that there are, so this is the partition function, and the free energy is just minus the log of it. So there are no non-analyticity at finite temperature for the free energy. So there are no classical phase transitions in 1D. OK, so this is the first result. Okay, let's see what else we can do. Actually, let me write it in a new blackboard. So once we have this, we can. Once you have the transfer matrix, you can also easily compute the correlation functions. So the correlation. I'm using the notation. I think that is in SACHDEF. So anyway, this is just the expectation value of the variable at the site L times the variable at the site L prime. And so how do we compute expectation values in a classical model? It's 1 over Z, the sum over all the speed configurations, L, of e to the minus h SL SL prime. So if you use the same type of steps that I used to compute the partition function, because this is almost like computing a partition function, only I have to put also these two variables that have two definite indices, right? So I just must be careful in the fact that these variables also are like a matrix, but they appear somewhere in this product sandwiched in the right location, namely when we arrive at the site L and the site L prime. So I leave it to you as an exercise, but it's really almost the same calculation, that this becomes 1 over Z, the trace of sigma z obviously is the matrix that represents SL. So I could put L here and L prime here. Right? It's a diagonal matrix that has plus 1 and minus 1. So it represents the two possible values of this thing, plus 1 and minus 1. So the closed expression for this object is possible, but it's not easy. I think you find the details in the book of SACHDEF or the references in it. Anyway, let's compute it in the lambda equals zero limit, so where our Hamiltonian only contains the Ising coupling. So this is an interesting limit also because in the following we are interested anyway in the case where K is large. So the phase that is ordered, so to speak. So in particular in this limit, the transfer matrix obviously is just e to the k, e to the minus k, e to the minus k, e to the k. And the eigenvalues simplify and become 2 cosh k and 2 sin h k. And also notice that these this matrix, so the eigenvectors are the eigenvectors plus and minus. Okay. So when you diagonalize this matrix here, this then this reduces easily for lambda equals 0 to a simple expression that I copy. Remember, this is the partition function, of course, just like before. It's this term. Okay. So I want to say so you will find a wider discussion about the scaling limit and universality in the book by Sachdev. But so let me tell you what are the essential parts before moving to the other side of the mapping. If you go so we want to take in account two things. So this is our lattice, right? And what we have is that we have these sites are labeled by some index L. And now we imagine that our lattice is embedded in real space. Okay? And this real space, so we have a distance between these two, that now it's not a graph distance, but it is a real number. So A, the lattice spacing. And we want to consider situations in which the short distances do not count. So we are both in the thermodynamic limit, so n is very large, but also we will consider very long distances. So what are very long distances? In order to know what is a macroscopic scale, we need to understand how correlated things are. Okay? So the correlation length gives you a meaning of what is a large distance. A large distance is something that is larger than correlation length. So if you take the thermodynamic limit of this expression, this becomes hyperbolic tangent of k to the L prime minus L. And this can define, I can rewrite this as e to the minus some parameter tau over psi, where by tau, I just mean so in particular, let's fix L equals 0. Okay, so my first spin is at 0. This one is 0. And tau, let me call it as AL. Okay. So when I count this distance and I am at the L spin, in real space, this is L sites times A. Okay. So this distance, I call it tau. And xi is defined in this way. Xi minus 1 is 1 over A log cot h k. So with this definition, this object becomes this. So you see that we have exponential decay of correlations, and we have defined this correlation length in this way. For large k, now we see that for large k, A over psi goes in this way. So for large k, we have correlations over a long distance, a distance that is much larger than a. So we make the guess that all the things that are important at a scale that xi that is much larger than a should not mind some details at the scale of a. Okay? So the assumption of universality is this, is that if I change something at the level at the scale a, when I look at large k, so when I have a large correlation length, I will find the same things. For instance, I will find the same expression for correlation functions. So this is the statement of universality. Indeed, one can try, so it's not easy exercise, but it can be done. If you add to this Hamiltonian the next nearest neighbor interaction, so you also couple sigma I with sigma I plus 2, and you go in the limit of large k, you will find again the same expression for correlation functions. So this is the statement of universality. Okay, so let's see how we can map when we can make this variable continuous, so when we can forget that A is a finite number, but we can think of A going to zero, which is like saying large, very large K. Let's see why this model describes also a quantum model. So we finish this part and understand why this is a mapping between a classical model and a quantum model. Okay. So we saw that our transfer matrix has that expression, okay? And that our partition function can be written like t to the n, where t is that guy. Okay, so let's start again from here, and bear in mind that at some point I will use this thing. Okay? So let me define two matrices, T1 and T2. T1 is this matrix, actually. The one for is T for lambda equals 0. So it is e to the k, e to the minus k, e to the minus k, e to the k. And T2 is e to the lambda, e to the lambda. Okay, so it's a simple exercise to verify that T is equal to T1 to the 1 half, T2, T1 to the 1 half. Okay? The cool thing, though, is that because here I'm taking the trace, and the trace is cyclic, so when I take the trace of T, so I'm taking the trace of this thing, then I can move around cyclically whatever is inside the trace. So this becomes the trace of just T1, T2 to the n. Very good. And so now let's use our scaling limit of large k. So this I can write it as e to the k that multiplies the identity plus e to the minus 2k sigma x. So here I didn't use any approximation. This is just another way of writing this matrix, right? It's e to the k times the identity plus e to the minus 2k sigma x. It's this thing, okay? And now let me use this thing. So for large k, this can be written like e to the k, 1 plus a over 2 psi sigma x. Right? I've just used this thing here. And then again, I can write it like exponent of a times e0, where e0 is just what makes this definition work, plus 1 over 2 psi sigma x. Okay? T2 is a simpler. Let me erase this. T2 is simpler, and it is just e to the a h tilde sigma z, where h tilde is defined by this expression. Okay, it's just lambda over a. I guess. Let me see. Yeah, h tilde is just. So this is just some algebra. So now let's put these things together. And so we see that I have the exponentiation of two operators. Right? I have the exponentiation. So T1 is a to the e to the a, that operator that contains sigma x.
The expression for T2, okay, because initial expression is a form of the matrix, should it be like e lambda and the next term?
No, T2 is defined by the fact that you need to verify that identity that I erased. If you define T2 in that way.
But if you write it in terms of sigma z, okay, and you expand it, okay, then mm-hmm. you get that it should be e lambda and e minus lambda, and you have a diagonal.
Oh, let me.
You have like e lambda.
Oh, yeah. Right. You're right. Sorry. I just forgot the answer. Thanks. Okay. So let me call this operator that is in T1, let me call it O1. And the one that is in T2 is O2. So I've written something like this, right? And what we have right now is that we want to compute the trace of this object to the n. So, and this thing is, actually I should write almost equal, because we did some approximations. So this is e to the a O1, e to the a O2. So I would really like to write this as e to the a O1 plus O2. But I can't, because these are not numbers. They are matrices. So they do not commute. And if they do not commute, this is not true. However, the error that you make is of the order of the commutator of the two. The commutator, you get a twice. So it's something that has order a squared. So that's why in the limit of a very small, I can make this approximation. Okay? So if I disregard what happens at very short distance. But now this is nice. Because, OK, so let's spell out what is this. This is e to the minus a, e0 minus 1, 2 over psi, sigma x minus h, sigma z. And this defines, so let me call this operator H, HQ. So you see that the transfer matrix is the time evolution in imaginary time, because A is a real number, so this is imaginary time, of a quantum Hamiltonian. And it is the quantum Hamiltonian of a single spin. So one can see the transfer matrix as the time evolution, so a transfer matrix of a one-dimensional spin system, classical, and it is what is transferring you from what happens at the spin L to the spin L plus one. You can see it as the time evolution in imaginary time of one single spin that is evolving in time. So it's transferring the state of the spin at some time tau to the time tau plus A. So this is the classical quantum mapping. When we finally finish taking, you know, when we, so now let's finish the calculation and let's compute the partition function. Now, what is n? N is equal, so if you have L is the length of the chain, means it is equal AN, right? So this becomes the trace of e to the minus HQ L. This is the transfer matrix, then times n, this becomes L. So you see that another feature of the classical quantum mapping is that this is the same partition function. It's the partition function of the initial model. So you see, the partition function of the classical 1D model is equal to the partition function of the quantum model at a new temperature, that is not the temperature of the initial model that we called beta, a new temperature that is the inverse of the length of the chain. So what was a length in the classical model became a temperature in the quantum model. So you can describe the same partition function in two ways. This has been obtained in the limit of A very small, though. So one expression people use is that HQ is the scaling limit of the Ising model. Okay, this is just words. Okay, so this is it. So we see that we can map. So this is a very simple quantum model. It's quantum model one spin. We could map a 2D classical model in a quantum 1D model where the other coordinate is time. But it's very instructive to see this mapping the other way around. So tomorrow, we do the other side of the mapping. So we will start with the quantum model in 1D that is our over there, quantumizing model with the sigma x and the sigma z. And we will see that we can map it onto the classicalizing model in 2D. These mappings are very important because very often you know things from one side of the mapping because they were already known before or because they're easier to compute. And then you can transfer them to the other way. In particular, basically to find the exact solution of the 2D Ising model, classical, basically the way it was found is by diagonalizing the 1D quantumizing model. And this is done with a procedure that is called Jordan-Wigner transformation that I believe you will do in the tutorial tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it is a bit of a long procedure and a bit, you know, you have to be careful doing all the calculations. It's a very powerful tool in theoretical physics that can be used in many, many different contexts, not only in condensed matter theory. Okay, so I'm finished for today. Questions?
Just can you repeat this? So do you mean that this transformation, so 1D classical Isaac model is equivalent to one quantum spin, actually?
So to one, yeah. When I say that they're equivalent, what I mean is that they have the same partition function, but at different temperatures, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So the mapping is a mapping. It doesn't
just I'm asking, so this Hamiltonian describes just one spin.
This Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian of a single spin.
Mm.
Is it a general fact that you can do this quantum classical correspondence that you lose a dimension?
Yes, it's a general fact. So every time you do the classical quantum mapping, you see that the statistical mechanics of a classical model doesn't contain time. It's just counting the spatial configurations. But you can interpret one of these directions in space, like the time evolution of so you can have a lattice in which so the spins are on the sides and these are two special dimensions, and the transfer matrix is telling you how these configurations on this line are related to the configurations on this line. But you could imagine that instead, I have a 1D model, and then I have a quantum Hamiltonian by which this model evolves, and the transfer matrix that is a unitary operator is the exponential of a Hamiltonian, is relating how the line at this time relates to the line at a later time. The only thing that you have to be very careful with is that this is an imaginary time. So this means that there are some things in the mapping that can be interpreted in the right way. So for instance, the partition function is good. But if you start trying to compute things like autocorrelation functions at different times, to go from to interpret the imaginary time like the real time, You want the correlation functions in real time to a physical meaning. This analytic continuation, you know, it's not guaranteed to work. So it depends. You have to do it model by model. So you have to be careful with this. But the partition function is. Question?